From today, we're going to be changing our format slightly to bring you the best in-depth coverage of coronavirus that we can. For now, we're going to drop our shorter second item so that we can focus on one story each day while this unprecedented global crisis continues to unfold. Today, we look at the British response and ask, is it strong enough? How are you coping with all of this?
In what sense?
In a personal sense.
It's quite troublesome, actually. Worrying that I about covering the story, but also not being able to let it go. I mean, that's going to be the chief problem, I think. Just thinking about it all the time. Then I suppose everybody else is too.
Guardian health editor Sarah Bosley is right. Everyone is thinking about coronavirus pretty much all of the time. It's frightening and it can feel all-consuming. One of the questions on many of our minds is whether our governments are doing the right thing.
You cannot fight a fire blindfolded, and we cannot stop this pandemic if we don't know who is infected. We have a simple message.
The World Health Organization says test. And has supported draconian measures to lock down citizens. Britain had seemed to be taking a different, more gradual approach. Boris Johnson then appeared to ramp things up at a press conference yesterday.
Last week, we asked everyone to stay at home if you had one of two key symptoms, a high temperature or a new and continuous cough. Today, we need to go further. Without drastic action, cases could double every 5 or 6 days.
But did it amount to a fundamental change of strategy? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, is Britain still out of step on coronavirus? Sarah Bosley, health editor at The Guardian. Can I start by asking, if you're sitting in the headquarters of the World Health Organization in Geneva right now, you're looking around the world and you're urgently trying to figure out what can possibly stem this deadly disease. What are they seeing? What different choices have countries been making?
So what you have in the Far East are countries like China, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, that are really cracking down massively. So you've got whole cities in lockdown. And this is the example that China set everybody else. They told everybody to stay home, cancelled all public transport. They took every possible control measure they could. In some other Asian countries, for instance, South Korea, I know that they're monitoring people's movements by satellite if they've tested positive, so that they can show people on a website where people have been, and therefore other people will know if they were at risk of being infected in those places.
That's amazing. And they're testing everyone they can.
They're testing everybody they can. They're then tracking their contacts and quarantining those people. So it means that they're hunting down the virus in every way possible.
Okay, so all that was happening in Asia, and then the centre of the pandemic moved to Europe. What did we start to see in terms of the response here?
Italy didn't take any of these containment measures, suddenly found itself with a massive problem, huge epidemic taking off. So they reacted.
Ci sarà l'Italia, un'Italia zona protetta.
They had a very reactive approach to lock down cities, stop people moving about. They closed restaurants and bars and cafes. Spain is now taking drastic measures as well. They have drones in the streets to monitor people who are going out because they've been told to stay at home. Planes from the UK were turned around mid-flight over southern France because all the places that people would want to go on holiday to, all the monuments, all the restaurants, they're all closed.
La fermeture à compter de ce soir, minuit.
France has closed restaurants and cafes. The Netherlands and Poland have closed their borders. And Ireland's closed its schools.
Where possible, teaching will be done online or remotely.
All of which seems in stark contrast to the strategy that the UK began to lay out last week with a mantra, we're following the science.
At all stages, we have been guided by the science.
What did they say?
They said that anybody who's got any of the symptoms, which is basically a cough and a temperature, should stay at home for 7 days.
Then you should stay at home for at least 7 days to protect others and help slow the spread of the disease.
And they said that that would reduce the number of infections by about 25%.
You get about a 20 to 25% reduction in peak with getting people to stay at home for 7 days if they've got mild symptoms.
They said the next step would be isolating whole families. So if somebody's infected, everybody stays at home for 7 days again. And that would also reduce the infections by 25%, they claim. So that's a 50% reduction.
If you went to the whole household isolation, and those are additive, so you'd expect to get up towards 50 plus.
And then they talked about isolating the most vulnerable people, especially those over the age of 70.
But what was also interesting was what they didn't say. What they didn't say was that they were ready to ban mass gatherings. Over the weekend, we saw rugby going ahead.
He's got it.
Even things like this massive Stereophonics concert in Cardiff, thousands of people huddled together singing their lungs out.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. I wanted to bring everyone up to date with the national fight back against the new coronavirus and the decisions that we've just taken in Cobra for the whole of the UK.
But look, things were really stepped up last night at another press conference.
So, first, we need to ask you to ensure that if you or anyone in your household has one of those two symptoms, then you should stay at home for 14 days.
If you have symptoms, you'll now be asked to isolate for 14 days instead of seven, and whole families will have to stay at home. Those plans for the elderly to be shielded from social contact for around 12 weeks start this weekend. And perhaps most striking of all, people are being told,
now is the time for everyone to stop non-essential contact with others.
Not to go to pubs, clubs, theatres, and to work from home wherever possible.
We need people to start working from home where they possibly can.
When it comes to mass gatherings, they still said that they don't think they are that dangerous, but they are now going to stop supporting them with emergency services. But while clearly all of that is a huge change, they are still not banning mass gatherings. All the other measures are voluntary, and they aren't closing schools. So while it is a shift, it still feels like we're taking a less draconian approach than other European countries, and certainly than China. And the mantra is still all about the science. It's notable that the Prime Minister was once again flanked by the Chief Medical Officer, Chris Whitty, and the Chief Scientific Officer, Sir Patrick Vallance. What are their scientific backgrounds?
Well, they're very good. Chris Whitty is an epidemiologist and he's worked on Ebola, for instance. He was deputy to the chief medical officer, Sally Davis, before this job. So he's a really good scientist. Everybody respects him. And Sir Patrick Vallance, likewise, you know, proper scientist. However, they are not relying on their own knowledge. They are using data from modellers. We're dealing with an unknown situation here. So what's happening is that the experts who know about modelling, who can actually use mathematics to figure out where this epidemic is going, are working night and day to sort out what we should be doing.
Who are those academics?
Well, there are some very, very good people. There's Neil Ferguson, for instance, who's a professor at Imperial College London. He was one of the founders of the MRC Centre for Global Infectious Disease Analysis, which really is a leading light. And we know that they're producing loads of data for the government. They have a website where they publish a lot of it. But Obviously, they haven't got time to answer questions from us.
I've seen a Q&A with him online from earlier in the crisis in which he talks quite openly about the very difficult choices that governments are facing.
So I think kind of fundamental decisions have to be made by countries as to whether they're going to follow what WHO is recommending and what the Chinese did, namely attempt to suppress all transmission, or alternatively try to mitigate, in some sense control an epidemic, but short of completely stopping spread. And it's an important distinction because in the former case, effectively that's a strategy which, I mean, in theory, if it works, could you know, largely prevent deaths from this infection, but would really have to be kept in place for 12 to 18 months until we have a vaccine available at scale. So that has enormous feasibility issues, and can any society really maintain those sort of controls for that long? Clearly has huge economic and social issues associated with it. I mean, the alternative is in some sense no easier. The idea of kind of mitigating an epidemic which is though fundamentally allowed to run its course until basically it stops because it runs out of people and develops herd immunity. Not everybody in the population get infected. We'd estimate the best you could do though that half the population get infected. You're still talking about an enormous epidemic in each country, and even if we do our best to protect those most vulnerable, the elderly, people with pre-existing health conditions, still potentially a very high health burden, both in terms of deaths and in terms of demands on hospital healthcare systems. So there are no easy options here. I mean, the next few months are going to see, almost regardless of which particular strategy is adopted, we'll see many countries in the world, if not all countries in the world, see kind of major dislocating social changes just as a result of the interventions which need to be put in place.
Another thing that feels to me that it fits into this same idea that we're not quite at the same level of intensity as other countries is around our testing policy. Yesterday, the government claimed that they are ramping this up. But every day, we hear stories of people with coronavirus symptoms in the community not being tested. I heard of one man who was really quite ill being told the only way they could get a test is to go private and pay £400. They seem to be focusing only on cases in hospitals. Is that a worry?
Actually, that is a bit of a problem because you won't know, for instance, if you've had it and therefore you're now probably immune and therefore safe to go and visit an elderly relative. Or perhaps you could still infect them. So that's one of the problems. And I've also heard from people in hospitals who are saying, we're really anxious because we've got COVID-19 patients and our nursing staff are not being tested. So we don't know whether they're picking up the virus from the hospital and then taking it out into the community. And although there are private tests out there, they haven't been validated by the public health experts at the NHS. So I don't necessarily think it's a good idea for anybody to go and spend money on that.
That doesn't mean that we assume our numbers are as low as the tests are showing, does it? They do estimate what they think the overall state of play is.
Yes, we know we've got far more cases, multiple times more cases than we actually count. And that's even when we were testing in the community. Now what they'll be able to do is to extrapolate from the numbers who are seriously ill in hospital. If you assume that's 20% of those people who have the disease, you can figure out roughly how many others have got it.
Like I said, we're not going to do our second comment story for now, so our main story will continue after this. Sarah, from everything you've told me, it does sound like even after what we saw last night, even though that is going to mean big social change, that we are taking a slightly more gradual, certainly more voluntary approach than other countries. Why is the government doing that?
What everybody wants to do, and they're choosing different ways to do it, is to flatten the curve of the epidemic, the same number of cases, but actually over a longer time frame. So the NHS is more able to cope with it. is a different way of going about it. It may perhaps lead to the same end, that we will reduce the numbers of infections and reduce the impact on the NHS, but it's all a bit of an experiment.
And look, the government claims that this strategy is now similar to others across the world at the same stage, but I'm not sure that stacks up. Ireland has fewer cases but has already closed schools. Other European countries have closed their borders. And in China, people were forced into isolation. There was also much more widespread testing in South Korea. Here, they keep talking about the science. But why have scientists elsewhere been saying something else?
Well, everybody has the same data. But the people who are doing the mathematical modelling on the effect of various interventions for our government appear to be coming to different conclusions from the scientists, for instance, who advise the WHO. The WHO is actually inspired by what has happened in China. And actually, it really has there brought the case numbers down. There's no denying it. A whole international team headed by Dr. Bruce Aylward went there to see what was happening. And they went with a sceptical view, actually, and came away thinking this is just incredible because the Chinese really have managed to put a lid on it and to turn it around. So now you've got actually very few cases coming out of China because of the draconian approach, as we used to call it, that they took.
And I guess one of the questions is the long term, because while it's clear that China has had some success at flattening the curve and now bringing the numbers down, there are worries that by controlling it so much, they might actually have left the country with a lack of immunity and that it could hit again.
It's always possible. That is the big worry that people have about the China situation, that once they take the controls off, the virus will just start to circulate again and then the cases will take off. So we don't really know what's going to happen. At the moment, it seems that China really has suppressed the virus to very low levels. They're getting very few new cases. And that's not just in Wuhan, where it all began, but actually across the rest of the country, where they didn't have the same sort of epidemic.
So look, one thing that really stuck with me was back in Geneva at the World Health Organization quarters. I said that they'd been scrutinizing policy across the world. And as you say, they pointed to China and South Korea as the best examples. Obviously, there's a lot of uncertainty in how all of this works. People are relying heavily on assumptions. How confident can they be that that model, the more draconian approach, is the right one?
They can't be at all sure. They just think that on the evidence they've got so far, that approach, the really tough crackdown, the lockdowns, the isolation, the testing, that has brought results. It's brought quite dramatic results for China. And it's working for South Korea and Taiwan and other countries that have implemented it. So looking at that, they are saying, this is what we would go for. And that's our advice to you. But they can't be certain.
I don't envy anyone who's having to make these incredibly high stakes, high risk decisions on how to contain a pandemic that is probably the most frightening thing that many of us have ever seen. When will we really know whether they were right or wrong?
I think we won't know until it's all over. I think in 6 months, maybe a year from now, we'll look back and we'll see what's happened. And then we might know the answers. But actually, at the moment, we're in the middle of a massive experiment. Something that we've never done before.
Sarah, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Sarah Bosley, who is writing about this non-stop. Do follow her coverage online and keep up with the latest developments on the live blog. Search online for The Guardian's morning briefing and sign up to get the latest as soon as you get up as well. Science Weekly Extra will be out today, so have a listen to that. That's all for now. My thanks to Sarah Bosley. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.